Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Rest is History bonus episode. Tom, welcome back to the island of Great Britain.
Thank you very much, Dominic. So, yes, you probably all have realised that the live show that we were meant to be doing on Monday evening, that we couldn't do it due to the fact that a storm intervened. And I'd been over to Belfast. I was doing an event there, but I wanted to see it properly. I'd never been before. So the storm then blew in. All the flights got grounded. So Sadie and I had an extra day there, which were actually brilliant. It worked out fantastically because it enabled me to have a wonderful tour of all the murals and the places associated with the Troubles that otherwise I wouldn't have seen.
Right.
So I just want to give a shout out to Nicholas Tate, Dominic, who produced the show on Radio Ulster that we were on a few months back.
Yes. I've often been on Nicholas Tate's show, Tom.
And he gave us such a brilliant tour all around. We went to the Shankill Road, we went to the Fool's Road, we went to the cemetery, we went to Stormont. So we saw pretty much everything. And it was really fascinating. You've done it, haven't you? You've done a tour of the...
Yeah, I have. Was that your first time in Belfast?
Yes. So I've kind of flown in and done various radio items on, I don't know, Bronze Age graves and things out in the wilds. But I hadn't actually been to Belfast. So we really wanted to make a trip of it. And I just thought the whole thing was fascinating. It was interesting because as we speak, we're recording some episodes on 1974, the year of two elections in Britain, which has this awful kind of drumbeat in the background of violence in Northern Ireland, particularly in Belfast, and also bombings on the British mainland, as it would be put. So I was reading up your books on that in Belfast, but also we're preparing to do some episodes on the Titanic. And actually, that was the thing I initially was most interested in seeing. So there's this brilliant hotel, the Titanic Hotel. They've kind of basically renovated all the docks, all the places where they were built, the Titanic and other great ships. And the building where the plans for the Titanic were drawn up, it's now part of the hotel, so you can go and have a drink there. And they've done it brilliantly. And I just want to put on the record, I am not being paid by the Titanic Hotel to boost it. But I mean, if you have any interest in Edwardian shipping, you'll be in heaven.
Yeah, of course.
They have all the posters everywhere. Oh, it's great. Really great. And the museum itself, sensational.
So Theo, our producer, Tom,
yeah,
has pointed out that you've forgotten it. You went with him to Belfast a year ago.
That's true. Yes, because we had a kind of passport snafu, but I don't really count that.
Poor Theo. Oh, that is so harsh.
No, because Theo had two trips to Belfast, but he didn't see anything. I mean, we didn't see anything of interest at all. We just sat in the passport office.
In the chat, he's written the words, horrible man.
No, Theo knows what I mean, because I remember we sat there and we said, oh, should we go and see something?
Yeah.
Should we go and see the docks? Should we go and see?
But you felt that seeing it with Theo would be a waste of time?
We didn't have time.
No, of course. Harsh, so harsh.
And I vowed there and then that I would come back and do it properly.
And sorry, I totally interrupted you. You were saying something about Edwardian shipping.
No, I was just saying about the museum, which is built next to the dock where they were building the actual Titanic, and it became the slipway down which it ran to sail off. And it's completely comprehensive, enormously detailed treatment of the economy of Belfast, of the political situation, of the process by which the Titanic was built. There's a ride, you go in a kind of little buggy and it takes you up and down so that you you feel kind of heat. They say, you know, the fires were blazing so that they could mold the steel and you feel a blast of heat, all great stuff. And then the actual sinking, very sensitively done. It was brilliant. I have to say though, I didn't meet anyone in Belfast who had actually been to it.
Oh, really?
So I urge any listeners in Belfast who haven't been to it, do go and see it. It's really good.
Yeah. So former guest and friend of the show, Paul Rouse, Tom, he wrote a thing about Belfast in 1911, 1912, I think for the Irish National Archives. And you can find it online.
Oh, I'll go and read that then.
So it's all about a sort of panorama of Belfast in the Edwardian period, the pubs, what sports people played, the jobs, the sort of the working world, all that kind of thing. Because he heard that we were going to be doing an episode about the Titanic. And he said, oh, I wrote this. Why don't you have a look at this? Which was very nice of him. So you said you went to see all the murals. Mm. So for people interested in history, I think it's an absolutely fascinating thing because the murals are steeped in a sense of history, aren't they?
Are about history.
They're absolutely about history.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed to me, I didn't see them all, but all the ones that I saw were kind of structured around three main political events. One of which, and this was the one that was least name-checked, and I was surprised to find that, was the Battle of the Boyne and William III, you know, which is kind of the inspiration for the Orange Order and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there's a very large one that we saw from our hotel, because on the night that we'd stayed in the Titanic Hotel, then we had to because the flight got cancelled, we had to book ourselves into another hotel. So we went to the Europa Hotel, Dominic.
Oh, yeah.
Which,
famous.
Of course, you'll know all about the most bombed hotel in Europe, it was, I think, before the Balkan War. So it's where all the journalists stayed during the Troubles, and it was always being blown up.
Yeah.
That was also an excellent hotel, by the way. So big shout out to the staff there who were lovely to us. And they gave us a very nice room with a view out of this big mural showing William III on a horse, gazing at this bridge that he had crossed over while going off to fight the Boyne. And so I was expecting more like that. But actually, I think that was the only one referring to the 17th century politics that I saw.
Right.
There were lots of murals talking about Sir Edward Carson.
Oh, yes.
So we also went to Stormont, this great kind of marble complex up on a hill over Belfast with a massive statue of Sir Edward Carson. So people may have listened to the episodes that we did on Ireland, and Sir Edward Carson featured in that prominently, didn't he?
The father, in some ways, of Northern Ireland, isn't he, Sir Edward Carson?
Yes.
Yeah, the great unionist firebrand.
So lots of references to him. But actually, the episode from history that was referred to over and over again was the First World War. And I had not appreciated the massively salient role that it clearly plays in kind of unionist emotional language.
The Somme in particular, I think, Tom, isn't it? The Battle of the Somme.
The Somme in particular, yeah. Although, interestingly, there was also a reference to an Ulsterman who, when Allenby took control of Jerusalem in 1917 in the First World War, had taken command of a brigade of Jewish soldiers.
Right.
And they were all kind of speaking in Hebrew and everything. And he died, I think, in America, was buried in Los Angeles. But his ashes were then brought back to Israel. And Benjamin Netanyahu gave a kind of a speech in praise of him. And this was the other intriguing thing, how omnipresent allusions to Israel were in the loyalist kind of heartlands. There were Israeli flags everywhere.
Right.
You'd see the Union Jack kind of melding into the Star of David. And conversely, in the Republican areas on the Fool's Road and so on, Palestinian flag everywhere, murals showing Palestinians in jail and comparing them to the hunger strikers.
Mm-hmm.
You can see why Ulster Unionists would identify with Israel.
Yeah. They see themselves as embattled, betrayed, surrounded by enemies. Yeah.
But also a kind of chosen people, I guess.
Uh-huh.
You know, and equally you can see why Republicans would identify with the Palestinians.
Yeah.
Oppressed minority.
Yeah.
Under the heel of imperialist entity, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting. And there was one Protestant guy I spoke to in one of the pubs. I felt so like a kind of British journalist on the spot, who said something that I hadn't appreciated. Because you remember all the graffiti that you'd always see Brits out?
Yes.
I had always assumed that that was a reference to the British Army. But he was saying, no, it's a reference to people who self-identify as British.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Which I had never thought of before.
You mean it's Republican graffiti saying, why don't you get out? Yeah.
Yeah. So rather like Palestinian rhetoric towards Israel.
Well, this used to be an issue in the 1970s. So sometimes journalists would be talking to, journalist Kevin Myers talks about this in his book, Watching the Door. He's not everybody's cup of tea, but it's a really incredibly evocative book about the atmosphere of Northern Ireland, Belfast in the mid-70s. And he talks about meeting people from Sinn Féin or the IRA and saying, you know, what do you think would happen to the unionists? And they basically say, well, either they have to turn into proper Irishmen or they just have to get out. You know, it's one or the other.
Yeah, which is, I mean, there are obvious similarities with the situation in Israel. But also just to say that that thing about being British, not Irish, is the kind of the great plot twist in Ulster American, which I think I mentioned before, the play that was on in Hammersmith with Woody Harrelson and Andy Serkis.
Yes.
But also with Louisa Harland, who plays a playwright from Ulster, who Woody Harrelson, as an American actor, assumes is Irish in a Catholic sense, but turns out to self-identify as British, to be Conservative voter, and to have voted for Brexit, which results in kind of absolute explosion. But she was in Derry Girls.
Right.
Which Sadie and I also watched while we were in Belfast, which I thought was brilliant.
God, you've really been getting into it, Tom.
Yeah, I really got into it. And also the kind of the freshness of the things that I was seeing was in part because we'd also watched last year this incredible documentary, Once Upon a Time in Northern Ireland. Have you seen it yet?
I haven't actually.
It's so good. And what was interesting was that everyone we spoke to about it in Belfast also thought that it was good, thought that it was the best thing that they'd seen on it. So all of that I recommend. And we will be doing more on Belfast in due course.
Oh, definitely.
A series on the Troubles. And of course, we've got our series on the Titanic to come.
So Just to give people a sense of where we are, we had the three episodes of The Narcissist in Power last week. This week, we've got A Man in the Iron Mask and, of course, Romans in Space, Tom.
Romans in Space coming tomorrow.
Yes. And next week, we are getting into the Peasants' Revolt. So we're going back to medieval England for the Peasants' Revolt and the reign of Richard II and the career of Geoffrey Chaucer. So much to look forward to.
Non-stop goodies.
And then we're into 70s Britain. So lots of fun things. Right, let's do a load of questions. I'll throw questions at you and you tell me what you think. So is Githan on the Discord? Which historic figures would have been broken, Tom, if they'd had the equivalent of the English tabloid press to deal with?
Well, the existence of a highly abusive tabloid press is expressive of a certain democratic culture.
Of course it is, Tom. That's the right answer.
That requires kind of a sense of the importance of freedom of speech.
Healthy irreverence.
I know that another way of framing it is saying that it's...
vicious and cruel.
You know, the viciousness of tabloid attacks is a reflective of the power of capital.
Right.
So either way, I mean, either they are tribunes of the people or they are the attack dogs of capitalist entities. But either way, they are expressive of a particular culture that is, I think, inherently kind of liberal, capitalist, democratic. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you wouldn't have had the equivalent, because I'm thinking, say, of the Romans, where... You know, you read Suetonius or Tacitus, the attacks on the emperors in those historians are kind of vituperative, even by the standards of the British press. If they had been made to the faces of Caligula or Nero, horrific consequences would have followed.
Do you know what? I think about the tabloid press. So the implication of the question is the English tabloid press is a recent phenomenon or remarkable in some way. But as you know, Tom, I'm writing an Adventures in Time about our old friend Horatio Nelson. Yeah. When Nelson got back from Naples, you know, he was the hero of the Nile, you know, all this.
And they're all after him.
He was gutted. He couldn't believe it, that there were all these Gilray cartoons and things that absolutely ripping into him.
Yeah.
He was a figure of fun to a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, that's bred of the, ultimately goes back to the explosion of pamphleteering in the Commonwealth, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. What a contrast with the slavish treatment of that terrible villain, Boney, that you would go on the other side of the channel.
So there are obviously cultures where abuse of great men, of great political figures does happen, and indeed of women, as great women as well. Mm. So the traditions of vituperation in Rome derive from the republican traditions, and they slowly fade out under the autocracy of the Caesars. Likewise, democratic Athens, the abuse that Aristophanes ladles out to the most prominent figures in the democracy, I mean, is unbelievably abusive. It still kind of stings 2,500 years on. But would you get it in Egypt or Persia? I mean, you might do.
No, of course not. You wouldn't. No way.
I mean, there's that graffiti on the ostracon that we did in the episode of Hatshepsut, implying that she'd been carrying on with her vizier.
Yeah, I've forgotten that, yes.
That's not something that's being published as a kind of cartoon for all the people across Egypt to read it.
Or, you know, I mean, the reign of Henry VIII, where it's forbidden even to envisage the death of the king.
But I suppose we're not answering the question, though, are we? You'd have to be very weedy, I think, to be broken by it. Maybe Henry VI, do you think?
To be broken by it? No, Henry VI would have gone and prayed.
I guess.
He would have been broken. Charles I would not have enjoyed it.
Well, he didn't, did he?
No.
I mean, he'd have been put in the pillory. But he wasn't broken by it, because he had confidence in himself.
Broken by it. Prince Harry, I suppose, is the... I mean, you're looking for someone like Prince Harry.
Yeah, but I think if Prince Harry had been around in the Middle Ages, I mean, he wouldn't have bothered suing his critics, would he?
No, he wouldn't. Well, he's dropped the case now.
Right.
Who would have been broken? Richard II.
No, because he bides his time and then he gets his vengeance.
Okay, maybe, fine.
Anyway, we can't think. We'll have a ponder on that, and maybe if we come up with someone, we'll answer later.
Okay, Tony Bang. Did Edward I forge the beginnings of the United Kingdom? Or did his conquests, hammering the Scots and so forth, and building castles in Wales, Tom, did they set the path for disunity between the home nations for centuries to come? So unifier or divider?
I think Edward I's campaigns against the Scots definitely play a key role in forging the sense of Scottish national identity that exists today.
Okay. Yeah,
I think that the relationship between the kingdoms of England and Scotland were informally much better, and the kind of sense of commonality between England and Scotland was much greater before Edward I's campaigns.
Yeah, Interesting. So a war is always the great, war is the handmaiden of nationalism, isn't it, Tom?
I mean, the thing is that England and Scotland were incredibly similar. They were both British kingdoms that had been conquered by Normans and had a French-speaking aristocracy, same religion.
Yeah.
In the most significant, most economically vibrant parts of Scotland spoke the same language. So in a sense, what Edward I's invasions did was to sharpen a sense of difference that otherwise might not have been so manifest. But the Scottish Wars are obviously, Scottish Wars of Independence are obviously a brilliant theme that we must do at some point.
Yeah, that would be a good theme. I'd enjoy that. Okay, I'm going to ask you another question. Al the King. Tom, the Balkans were once known as the powder keg of Europe. But what area of the world has over the last 2,005 years most consistently been a powder keg? It's a powder keg or tinderbox.
Or put in the shadow of a gathering storm.
Exactly. The storm clouds will gather over this place.
I'd say Canaan, stroke Israel, stroke Judea, stroke Palestine. Stroke...
See, I thought you would say that. But is that true?
Yeah, it is, I think.
Because actually, once you get to the 6th, 7th century, after that...
Crusades.
Yeah, but then you've got it's a big gap before the Crusades, right? It's 400 years or something.
Yeah, but we're talking about 2,500 years. It's the hinge between Mesopotamia and Egypt.
Yeah.
And so therefore, armies are always tramping across it.
I suppose so.
And the control of it massively matters. So it's a point of war between Alexander and
Darius
and the Persian king.
Yeah.
It's the classic kind of stamping ground between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids.
It is. Yeah.
The Maccabees declare independence and establish a kingdom that then comes up against the Romans. There's the sequence of Judean revolts. It's then, for religious reasons, becomes a flashpoint between Christians and Muslims. And I agree that with the end of the Crusades, to a degree, it then ceases being a powder keg. But I would say strategically, it still remains vital. And the fusion of kind of being strategically important and religiously significant means that it is...
So there is a long period of somnolence under the Ottomans.
Well, a powder keg doesn't have to go off, Dominic. Does it? It just has to have the potential to explode.
It needs the fuse, Tom, and it needs the matches.
Right. But I would say that, it's a powder keg that's sitting there and then it gets fitted up with a fuse in the 20th century and matches periodically get dropped in it.
Right. Well, the Crimean War is partly motivated by massive arguments about supervision of the holy places, isn't it?
Yes. So what would you say?
I mean, obviously, I thought of Israel. So I was just playing devil's advocate because I thought it would be a very boring answer. And I was trying to think of something more...
Left field.
Yeah.
Sandbrookian.
Berwick upon Tweed. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
The borderlands of England and Scotland. I don't know. I think a powder keg. I mean, the Balkans, you see, the funny thing about the Balkans weren't really a powder keg for a long period of time either. Especially when they were there under the Ottomans. I mean, who cared? They just kind of got on with life, with being shepherds and all that stuff. When the Bosnian War broke out in the 1990s, there was this great thing, particularly in Washington, that this was the product of these deep, ancient hatreds. But actually, a lot of historians said the hatreds are modern. They are the product of the 20th century. In the 17th, 18th century, no one was talking about ancient hatreds. Anyway, this is all by the by. All right, Danny Kay's got a good question. Ask about Toryism. It seems to Danny there's no connection between Jacobite Tories in the late 17th, early 18th century and Tories 100 years later, who are basically the more anti-French Revolution Whigs. Is this broadly accurate? And if it is, why? Do you want to know my answer to that, Tom?
Yes, I do.
I thought it would be unfair to ask you that question, given that I've asked you all the questions. And...
No, there was a definite slight feeling of panic as I saw that one.
Yeah, it's not really your... So the great man on this would, of course, be...
Capel Loft.
Yeah, former foe of the show, Capel Loft, who... is writing a book about Whigs and Tories, isn't he? But my sense is that the latest sort of historical thinking is there's actually virtually no relation at all. That the name lived on.
Because the name Tory is from Ireland, isn't it? And it's a bandit.
Yes.
Is that right?
I think that's right. And that Toryism survived for much of the 18th century as really a kind of cultural impulse, a kind of temperament, rather than any political movement or body.
Roast beef.
Yes, it's sort of, but it gets mixed up with court and country as well, which is another sort of binary. And then the idea of Toryism gets revived, I don't know, Napoleonic Wars or thereabouts. But for example, William Pitt the Younger, he's always referred to as a Tory politician. And he's listed in as Tory, you know, he's coloured blue in sort of Wikipedia entries and things. But he would have called himself a Whig. I mean, everybody at the time, almost everybody in politics thought of themselves as Whigs, not Tories.
But there are Tories in America, aren't there, during the War of Independence?
But there, the Tories mean loyalists, don't they?
Something slightly different.
Yes, again, different.
But wouldn't Tories in Britain define themselves in the same way? That they're loyal to the crown? And
yes, I suppose they would. So again, it would shade into that. They would be people who believed in the established church.
Church of England men.
Church of England and the crown. But I think by the time of, so for example, we mentioned Nelson. Nelson is the son of a vicar, isn't he, in Norfolk. He absolutely is loyal to the Church of England. He's totally loyal to the monarchy and to the British constitution and all that. But he would not have called himself a Tory. I mean, he wouldn't have actually called himself anything because there's no sense of party affiliation.
No, he's an Englishman and therefore he burns with zeal for king and country.
King and country, yeah.
Just comes with the territory.
His zeal for king and country keeps him warm, Tom. He doesn't need a coat.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the great thing about Nelson. All right, well, before we go, Tom, I know you have to crack on, don't you? You've got stuff, things to do.
I've got so much to do because I've been stranded in Belfast for an extra day, so I'm behind.
And because, Tom, I don't want to give too much away because Dan Snell will just do a 23-minute episode about our forthcoming series, but are you not going to be doing reading for the forthcoming series about Carthage?
Yes, I am. I've got Josephine Quinn's book on the Phoenicians waiting to be read this afternoon, so can't wait for that.
Oh, fantastic. I think she says they didn't exist. Doesn't she?
No spoilers.
Well, anyway, can't let you leave without asking you another question from a friend of the show, Tony Bang. I'm sorry not to see you at the Athelstan gig, Tony, by the way, but you know, you probably got something better to do. Anyway, Tony wants to know, who was the greatest knight in history? Was it William Marshall?
That's the conventional answer, isn't it?
Tony isn't saying that. I'm saying, is it William Marshall? Because I thought you would say William Marshall.
I think the Black Prince.
The Black Prince.
Yeah.
On what basis?
He's the model of chivalry.
And killing Frenchmen.
Yeah.
Brilliant. What a note on which to end. That's what we like on The Rest is History. Poor old Theo.
Well, because I think, I mean, you know, basically knights are all about combining the idea of murderous proficiency
yeah.
with a certain kind of Christian glamour.
Yeah.
And the Black Prince combined that brilliantly. I mean, he slaughtered enormous numbers of people, but he has that kind of aura of glamour. So yeah. Top marks for him.
Ultimately a kind man. and not, except in France, cruel.
Exactly so.
Right. Excellent. So, Tom, I will see you.
Your next adventure in time subject is just staring you in the face, Dominic.
So, talking of a great adventure in time subject, we're in the middle of recording a series about Britain in 1974. And there's some absolutely ludicrous behaviour happening in that series, isn't there?
And some very, very bad language.
Yeah, very bad language.
All of which will probably have to be bleeped out.
So you've got that to look forward to. Okay, we will see you next time. Thank you, as always, for all your support. We've got lots of fun things coming on the podcast in the near future. We've got the Titanic. We're going to record an episode about the history of chocolate. What else have we got, Tom? I can't even think.
Top monkeys.
Top monkeys. History's top monkeys. That's the one that the public are waiting for. So on that bombshell, goodbye.
Bye-bye.